Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI.
Welcome back. So today we're doing a deep dive into a really unsettling, I think, piece of work. It's Benjamin Labatut's When We Cease to Understand the World.
It's gained a lot of acclaim internationally, and it really sits at this strange intersection of history, science fiction.
Exactly. It forces you to think about the cost, really, the psychological cost of, well, of genius, particularly scientific genius.
That's right. Labatut's known for that blend, isn't he? History, math, philosophy. And the structure here, it's not your typical novel. It's more like a cascade of connected stories.
Following real people.
Real 20th century scientists and mathematicians, yeah. People whose ideas just completely reshaped how we see everything.
And the core idea we're tracking today, based on the book, is how that moment of breakthrough, how it can tip over into something quite terrifying, existential dread almost.
He wants to capture what he calls the vertigo of knowledge.
Vertigo of knowledge. I like that. So our mission here is to look at, what, four key ruptures, moments where understanding reaches this limit and it becomes, well, almost unbearable for the person discovering it.
Exactly. That feeling when the universe stops making sense in the old ways, the comfortable ways, and you suddenly see it's stranger, maybe more random, maybe even more destructive than you ever thought possible.
Okay, so let's begin where Labatut begins. It's quite an overture, isn't it, for Saber's story? It immediately sets up this this deep duality in scientific discovery.
How creation and destruction can come from the exact same place, and it starts quite innocuously, doesn't it, with a color.
Prussian blue. Almost sounds peaceful.
Right. A beautiful deep blue pigment, discovered actually by accident back in the 18th century. But Labatut, he follows the thread, he looks at the chemistry, the molecules.
And that's where it gets dark.
Very dark. That same line of chemical inquiry, the work that led to this vibrant blue, eventually leads to isolating hydrogen cyanide.
Which became the pesticide Zyklon.
And then, tragically, Zyklon B, the gas used in the Holocaust, Labatut draws this direct chilling line.
And right at the center of it all, you have Fritz Haber.
Haber. He's such a complex, deeply contradictory figure. His driving force seems to have been this intense German patriotism.
Wanting to serve his country.
Desperately. But look at the results. On one hand, pure creation, the Haber-Bosch process, synthesizing ammonia from air.
For fertilizer.
Which basically allowed us to feed the world.
Yeah.
Billions saved from starvation. He was called a savior of humanity.
But then the other side, World War I.
He takes that same brilliance, that same systematic mind, and applies it to war. He champions chlorine gas, oversees its deployment on the battlefield, becomes the father of chemical warfare.
It's staggering. The same mind, the same knowledge base, producing fertilizer and poison gas. How can that coexist in one person?
And the conflict wasn't just abstract. It hit home, literally. His wife, Clara Immerwahr, she was a chemist too, quite accomplished. She was horrified.
She couldn't reconcile his work with, well, basic humanity.
Not at all. She protested, argued, and ultimately she took his service pistol and killed herself. A direct response to his work.
That personal tragedy just underscores the public one. But Labatut takes it further, doesn't he? The final irony.
Oh, it's devastating. Haber, later in life, a Jewish man himself, is forced into exile by the Nazis.
And the pesticide developed from research at his institute.
Zyklon gets refined by the Nazis into Zyklon B. And it's used to murder millions, including, horrifically, members of Haber's own extended family.
It just hammers home the book's point, doesn't it? You can't separate the threads. The genius that saves life and the genius that takes it. It's the same intellectual force.
Exactly. And after showing us that horror in the physical world, you know, the chemical contamination, Labatut shifts gears. He moves us into the realm of pure thought.
From chemical warfare to theoretical nightmare.
Right. To the horrors that fractured our understanding of reality itself. And again, it starts in the trenches of World War I with Karl Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild. He was actually dying, wasn't he, while doing this groundbreaking work?
Yeah, serving on the Russian front, suffering from a terrible autoimmune disease. It was this desperate race against his own body's decay. He was pursuing what he called pure knowledge, almost as an escape.
And he's working with Einstein's field equations, these incredibly complex ideas about gravity and space-time. What does he find?
He finds the first solution. And within that solution lies something terrifying. The concept of a singularity.
What is?
A point of infinite density, zero volume. A place where all the known laws of physics just breakdown completely, where our understanding hits a wall.
The precursor to the black hole concept.
Precisely. Levitude calls it a mathematical seed of cosmic horror. Schwarzschild peered into the mathematical heart of the universe and found this abyss.
Wow. So that's the first theoretical rupture, but the biggest one, the one that truly shattered the old worldview. That's quantum mechanics.
Oh, absolutely. That's the climax of this section of the book. Labatow focuses on the intense rivalry, the intellectual clash between Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger.
Two giants trying to make sense of the subatomic world.
And getting very different, very disturbing answers. Heisenberg, Labatow portrays him almost like a prophet of this new strange reality. He's recovering from a bout of hay fever, isolated on an island.
Heligoland.
Right. And in this almost feverish state, he formulates the uncertainty principle.
Which basically says, you can't know everything precisely at the quantum level.
Yeah, fundamentally. You can know a particle's position or its momentum, but not both with perfect accuracy simultaneously. It's not just a limit of our tools, it's baked into reality itself. Reality at its core is probabilistic, uncertain, inherently unknowable in that old deterministic sense. Heisenberg kind of embraced the weirdness.
But Schrödinger didn't. He found it philosophically repulsive.
Deeply. He wanted to rescue certainty. He came up with his famous wave equation, which was elegant and powerful, but he couldn't escape the weird implications either.
And that's where the cat comes in.
Schrödinger's cat. He devised that thought experiment, the cat in the box that's both alive and dead until you look, specifically to show how absurd the mainstream interpretation, the Copenhagen interpretation, was.
He thought it was ridiculous.
He did. But ironically, his thought experiment became the most famous illustration of quantum weirdness.
Mm.
It just highlighted how bizarre and counterintuitive this new reality was.
And this is the key point Labatow keeps returning to, right? The psychological toll. These physicists weren't celebrating these breakthroughs, not entirely.
No. They were disturbed. They'd ripped open reality and found something alien, something that defied common sense. It led to this profound sense of vertigo. Despair, even, among the very people making the discoveries.
Which leads naturally to the next question. If knowledge can be this powerful, this potentially dangerous or even horrifying, what's the right response? What's the moral path?
Exactly. And that brings us to Alexander Grothendieck.
The mathematician. His story feels like it offers a kind of answer, or at least a response, to everything that came before, a path of renunciation.
It does. Grothendieck was this legendary figure in pure mathematics. His work was about finding deep, unifying structures. For him, math wasn't just calculation, it was almost spiritual, an act of pure, beautiful creation.
Absolute purity was the goal.
Yes. So imagine his horror when he discovered that some of his funding for his institute came from military sources.
That connection, however indirect, was unacceptable to him.
Completely. The idea that his abstract, beautiful creations, these pure forms of thought, could potentially be used, even tangentially, for destruction, for war. It was a desecration.
So what did he do?
He walked away. Completely. Renounced his prestigious position, abandoned the mathematical community he'd helped build, and retreated. Became a recluse, living in isolation, focusing on spirituality.
He chose to stop understanding the world through mathematics.
It was a conscious decision to cease that particular kind of knowing, a profound moral statement against the potential contamination of knowledge.
But hang on a second. Labatow presents this almost as a tragedy, this descent into an abyss. Yet all these discoveries, quantum mechanics, relativity, even Haber's chemistry, they're the bedrock of the modern world, aren't they? Our technology, medicine.
That's the tension, absolutely.
So is Labatow maybe overstating the horror? Or does he make a convincing case that the price was just too high? How does he make it feel so visceral?
Well, I think it's down to his method, this blurring of fact and fiction he does so well. He calls it speculative biography.
So he takes the historical record.
Uses the known facts, the real events, the real people. But then he goes inside their heads. He imagines their fevers, their breakdowns, their obsessions, their nightmares. He doesn't just report the discoveries. He makes you feel the psychological cost of making them.
You're experiencing the dread alongside the scientists.
Exactly. And that theme of madness and intellect just runs right through it. He repeatedly links the breakthroughs to extreme states.
Right. Schwarzschild dying, Heisenberg hallucinating on Heligoland, Haber's relentless, almost manic drive.
It suggests that maybe genius itself is a kind of affliction. that you have to be pushed to the very edge, mentally or physically, to see these truths.
And the imagery he uses is so potent, too. You mentioned the terrible greenness earlier.
Un verdor terrible. Yes, it recurs. This idea of knowledge is something wild, untamable, like a poisonous plant, maybe. It connects Prussian blue to cyanide, connects Haber's gas to, I don't know, the uncontrollable spread of quantum ideas. It suggests knowledge has its own life, and it's not always benign.
Okay, so pulling it all together. The book traces this arc from, say, the tangible horror of chemical weapons to the abstract horror of quantum uncertainty, and then to a kind of moral response in Grothendieck's withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
The core theme seemed to be this inherent duality, creation, destruction, the terrifying limits of our own understanding, and this deep alienation of genius. It really chips away at that simple, comforting story of scientific progress equals human betterment.
It certainly does. It shows how much struggle, how much psychological turmoil, and how much moral compromise underpins our modern reality. I think the lasting feeling it leaves you with is humility.
Humility in what sense?
Humility before the sheer strangeness of the universe. And maybe the idea that we can't understand everything through reason alone, that accepting the limits of rationality might actually be necessary.
That resonates with the final section, doesn't it? The Night Gardener. It feels different from the rest.
It does. It's quieter. It brings things back down to earth,
yeah.
Literally. Focuses on a gardener, on the simple, tangible knowledge of plants.
Including toxic ones like aconite.
Right. Deadly, but in a contained, understandable way. Almost. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? After all the cosmic horror and quantum paradoxes.
What are we supposed to make of that shift in scale? It almost feels like a quiet counterpoint.
Maybe it poses a question about the scale of knowledge itself. Is the kind of vast, world-altering knowledge pursued by Haber or Heisenberg inherently more dangerous than the small-scale, practical knowledge of the gardener?
Which leads to a final thought, maybe, for you, listening. Is there a fundamental difference between the knowledge that links a pigment to a poison gas and the knowledge a gardener has about which plant is deadly? Or is the potential for darkness, that verdor terrible, present in all forms of understanding, just waiting for us to grasp it? Is small-scale knowing somehow safer?
Something to ponder, definitely.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.